I just think it's really inspiring to hear, like, because the possibility, right? What possibility there is for you in making a dent. Because a lot of times we think, I'm just one person. How can I make a difference? I'm just one person. And you're going to make one person difference. And what came to me was, I'm just one person, and the world needs changing. I can't do it by myself. And that's when I decided to train other practitioners. And then each practitioner is going to train thousands of other people. So my effect goes out there, and then some of those people that you train are going to get excited, and they're going to say, I want to do this too. I want to be a health coach. I want to be a naturopath. I want to be an herbalist. And then they're going to help people. So it's this whole ripple effect, and eventually we get the whole world. They won't even know what hit them. Wow, I just chose a healthy lunch, and wow, my diabetic retinopathy is getting better. And so I'm just excited about it. So this afternoon, here's what's on tap. I want to go into genetics, the genetics of metabolic disorders. Now, last year we spent a whole conference on genetics, and we did more than just metabolic disorders. We did everything, when everything is a metabolic disorder. But anyway, and it took a lot of time. And genetics takes a lot of time to learn and to master. But let me tell you, genetics is only 5%, as you heard Louisa say, so why study it? Why? Remember what Dr. Allen said this morning about the biggest thing is getting people to do stuff, right? Genetics works beautifully. It scares the bejesus out of people. And they go, oh my God, no wonder I this, no wonder I that. Oh yeah, that means you've got to stop, you know, being exposed to gasoline fumes, and you better, and they're going, oh yeah, because I have really bad genetics on that, right? And I credit my energy, my stamina, my health right now, not to my genetics, but to the epigenetic modification that I've done. Because I made a decision when I was 28, 29 years old, that I made an observation first. There are no old people in my family. I don't even know what they die of. In late age, they die early of heart disease and cancer. I'm like, there's no old people in my family, so I'm going to do whatever I can. I must have bad genes, is what I said. I wasn't thinking at that point. I mean, it's also the bad habits. But so I said, I'm not going to go that path, because bad habits plus bad genes equals bad health, right? Bad habits plus bad genes equals bad health. Bad habits plus good genes equals bad health, right? Bad genes plus good habits equals good health, right? You just have to be more careful. There's less you can get away with, right? You can't have the Cheetos and the French fries like maybe somebody with the good genes can, because your body's not going to be as forgiving. But it just tells you what you can get away with, and it tells you how to motivate your clients. I remember we do, for this year-long program, we do a nutrigenomics day. And we basically, everybody gets theirs tested, and I go through the day, and I literally help them analyze and understand. Like with 20 people, all day long, I'm reading genetics. So I've gotten a little bit of experience doing that for the last 7 years and doing it quickly. But here's the thing. The reason I do it that way is that the people on the call are learning from the other people that came before them. And I tell them explicitly, take your report, and you can do this with any kind of lab, take your report, and as I'm explaining it to Susie over here, you look to see if you have any of those same markers and make notes for yourself. So by the time I get to the last person, the first person may take an hour to go through, the last person takes 10 or 15 minutes, and they do most of the work. Because they say, oh my God, I have just like what Jeannie had over there, and I have what... This is what I'm thinking I have to do, and I'll just fine-tune it, and we'll go, yeah, how motivated are you? Great. Boom, they're off. And I remember we got to the end of a 10-hour day. We have now split them into 2 days, because those 10-hour days weren't so bad on me, but they were really bad on the people that I was working with. And we got to the end of the 10-hour day. I realized we hadn't taken a break, and I hadn't peed in 10 hours. So that was a little weird, but I said, this woman got on and she started crying when it was her turn. I went, what's the matter? Are you okay? What's going on? She goes, you just explained my life. And I feel like my whole life, I was sensitive to everything. I would say when we went to the gas station, no, I can't pump the gas because it gives me a headache or it makes me feel bad. And everybody would laugh at me. Or my mother, I'd fall and I'd hurt myself and they'd give me a Tylenol. And I'd say, I can't take Tylenol because it makes me feel wacky, right? And it turned out that's what her genes were saying. Those pathways were compromised. Doesn't mean that she had to have a miserable life, but she learned early on to say no, but everybody made fun of her. Her family member, nobody understood her or supported her. Now she said, I can show them this paper. I can show them this and say, it wasn't me. It was in my genes. That's why I'm so sensitive. I'm not a hypochondriac. I wasn't trying to get out of pumping the gas or, you know, mowing the lawn or spraying pesticides on the lawn or whatever. It's in my genes, and I was trying to protect myself. And she was so relieved that she was crying at the end of this call. And it was very touching and moving, and I'll never forget that. And I think a lot of the people on the call felt the same way, you know? Wow, right? I don't have to get diabetes, but damn it, if I eat that sugar stuff, I'm gonna get it. And why is it that that guy down the street has been eating it his whole life, and he's still skinny, and he's still healthy? That's where the gene piece comes in, right? So that's where it's so important to understand how the body works, how the endocrinology works, and then understand the genes. So that's why we're going to do genes. Is that okay if I teach you about genes? Okay, it's okay if I only can teach you this much, and I know a lot more, because I can't teach it all. The nutrigenomics module is probably 30 or 40 hours long, not to scare you, but it has a lot of cases in it, because that's how you learn it. You learn it by listening to someone who knows what they're doing, going through. And not that I'm an expert at it, because there is nobody's an expert at this stuff, because it's a new science, right? And we're all just learning as we go and getting better and better and better and better. So genes, so this we're going to go over tomorrow. I just had this up earlier to show you that there's some stuff on ketones that you can tell from a test called the organic acid test, and it's a good test to know how to do, and we'll go through that tomorrow. So the genetics of metabolic disorders, the ones we're going to go through today, cardiovascular, blood sugar, digestion, autoimmune, and cancer. Okay? So what is nutrigenomics? Nutrigenomics is not knowing your genetics, because genetics is different. Nutrigenomics is understanding how your nutrition and your lifestyle interacts with your genetics. What factors in your life you get to choose, and you get to choose differently based on your genetics. And knowing the genetics helps you a great deal. Does anybody know what SNPs are? Anybody not know what SNPs are? A couple of you. SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms. It's what the lay population might call genetic defects, but they're not genetic defects. They're genetic differences from what we think is the normal or optimal way a pathway should run. But it's not just about pathways. Like eye color is a SNP. You know, you might have a SNP that says, you know, brown, brown. You may have a blue, blue, et cetera. So a SNP, single nucleotide polymorphism, it's just a little difference in the genetic coding in what's called the nucleotides, which are what make up the DNA. So how SNPs are reported on reports and the various kinds of reports. There's a sample of one genetic genie. You can get that done free after you've gotten the genetic coding done. You have to send in your sample and then get the genetic test done. You load up the raw data to different reports that tell you what it really means, but they don't really necessarily tell you what it really means. You got to still figure it out, but it's much easier than like 23andMe, which is the most popular one. Their reports are really like lame, super lame. Super lame. So we take the data that they derived and we put them through these other reports. And this is how it's usually reported. Green means it's called wild type, normal. But wild type, if you ever see that terminology, that means just you're normal. Why do they call it wild type? I have no idea. And it might be seen as parentheses minus, comma, minus. The yellow is what's called a heterozygous SNP. It means that if green, let's just say it was supposed to be AA. And that's what the normal, the wild type would be. And mommy gave you A, but daddy gave you C. That's a heterozygous. You got one that's not quite what it should be, right? And that's reported as yellow plus minus. And then the red is that both parents basically, you know, gave you a bum deal, right? They both gave you the wrong thing. And you're like, ugh. And when we look at these in terms of metabolic pathways, the ones that have heterozygous, the yellows, generally that pathway that's coded for might be 25% compromised, right? It may be slower or faster, we'll talk about that in a minute, by 25%. You know, maybe a little less, maybe a little more, but about 25%. Whereas when you have a red, a homozygous, plus, that one would be more like 65 to 85% compromised. And so some of these pathways, they're coded by multiple genes. You might see a report and say, MTHFR, 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 but then there's different subcodes. There's a lot of really important pathways in the body, and the body has backup systems. So depending on how many are out of balance. So there's no like straight numbers game when it comes to genetics. There's no like, oh yeah, that's the way it goes. No. But we just kind of guess it, and we go by our first thing is assessment, right? So part of the assessment is history taking. What symptoms do they have? What signs do they have? What labs are out of balance? And then their genetics. You can't just take a genetic report and tell somebody, oh my God, you have a B12 deficiency. You need to take B12. You can't do that, right? Because they may not. They may have epigenetically modified the expression of that so that you're doing just fine, or they may be eating so many, you know, good sources of foods that that pathway is not compromised. So a SNP can make the pathway slower or faster, tortoise and the hare, right? So if it makes, most of them make it go slower, quite frankly. So you're not converting from this chemical to this chemical because of the pathway is slowed down, but sometimes they're sped up. There's a few in particular like, CBS and a few others like that in the sulfation area, that if you have a SNP, you don't always know whether it's slower or faster just based on the report. So there's where the educated guessing comes in. So the next thing, wow, that's not hard to read. This is reference. They're harder to read on the screen than they were on paper. But you'll have this in your notes, and it's just a list, the next two pages, because somebody asked the other day, well, I've given you, like, where can we order these things? And it'll be on the page, and you can just read those. Okay. So let's look at each of these metabolic disorders, and we have about 35 minutes to get through this. So I'm going to give you some places to go. You've also got charts. Lynn and I made these most amazing charts last year. Who was there last year and got them? Were they like amazing, right? They're just the amazing charts that map out the genes and the SNPs and what the possible meaning might be all in one place. So for the cardiovascular, there's a number. You know that there's certain people that have just genetically high cholesterol, but they're not at risk. Right, because you can't just look at cholesterol. It's like they've just got the genes that code for them being high cholesterol. Now, if they are eating poorly and they have a lot of inflammation, then that high cholesterol is going to be bad for them. But if you look at and you do some of the more advanced testing, you look at the Dr. Allen talked about the buoyant ones and the buoyant and the dense LDLs. You look at that. You look at C-reactive protein. You look at homocysteine. And if they have this perfect homocysteine and perfect C-reactive protein, and they've got a lot of nice, like, fluffy ones and very few of the low ones and good HDL2s, then you're like, you know what? We're just going to watch this. You don't need statins. You don't have a statin deficiency. Let's do some nutrients to maybe shore that up, maybe some CoQ10 and niacin. And don't worry about it. It's going to be high, and it's going to be high forever because you got these genes, and that's just the way it is. Then we have familial hypobeta lipoproteinemia, lipoproteins, right? Those lipoproteins tend to get lower, the beta ones, because the beta ones are supposed to be protective, and the alpha ones are not protective. So you may actually have them low because you have genetics. Right? And again, you have to look at the big picture. And you also have to look at what's the insulin levels like, because insulin stiffens the arteries, right? How high is the blood sugar? Because the A1C, the hemoglobin A1C, if you don't know what that means, it's like what percentage of your red blood cells are coated with sugar. And if you've ever made molasses as a kid, right, or taffy, you stir the molasses, you get it nice and warm, and then you pull it, and then you let it cool, and it's stiff, right? That's what sugar coating on your red blood cells do. It gets stiffness in there, and you're going to have a problem, especially if you have stiffened arteries, and then you have narrowed arteries, and then you have a plaque buildup, and you've got this inflammation, and then you have C-reactive protein and homocysteine, you are just a heart attack waiting to happen or a stroke waiting to happen. So these are some of the things. And again, it's the protective lifestyle things that we do that make a difference. So these are just a list of some of the other cardiovascular-related diseases, genes. And on the charts, these are on the charts as well. And I've got the charts in full size that you can print out. You can do them 8.5 by 11 on your, or 11 by 14 on your computer, the big ones. Or you can print them out and take them to the printer and get them done in 14 by 17 or 11 by 17, the big, nice big ones. So you have these charts that you keep handy at your desk when you're working with people. And for the big reveal, that's what the charts look like. They're very hard to see. I guess they're pretty easy to see on the big one. On the little one down here, they're harder to see. But it says basically, what is the gene that's having the problem and the variation? And that's the way that it's reported in the medical literature. And then what does it mean, right? So what's the normal? What's the risk, right? And then what is the function of it? And what are the health risks? So you have a summary of all these on one page. It's just so much easier to go through somebody's genes when you have a summary on one page. But then there's more. Because we put across the top, what are some actions you need to take to protect these? And there may be some more boxes that could be checked, and maybe on edition two, we'll go back through and say, oh, we should really check off that. And you can always check more off if you think, you know, I think that one, you know, puts somebody at risk. But then what labs should you do to follow up? Because they may not have this gene expressed, and then they're okay. So you just follow up with the labs. Is that cool? These took us a lot of time. Oh, when you see how many we did like 17 of them. For all different genes. Now, we got a lot of the information from a book called, it's a test called geneticdetoxification.com, and you can see that on the list, but they have a book that goes with it, and it's a great report to get because next to the gene, it'll say pages 33 to 42. But what we noticed was there was a lot of repetition from one gene to the other because this was a detox gene or this was a cardiac gene and they had similar. So we lumped them together and put the action steps across the top to make it much easier. But the easy way for you to get started, you get the book and you run the test and do it on yourself or a family member and then just play with it and read it. Right? It's just great. The genetic detoxification, go to there for this, the website, and the book is something related to genetics. I don't remember the exact name of the book. Geneticdetoxification.com. And it's in the slides, so if you, you know, just go home and take a look at them. And one reason I like for not giving you or not encouraging you to print off slides for when you're doing these things is because it forces you to go back and review your material. And I find for myself, if I just take notes and then I go back, then I go through the materials, then I'm second pass through, right? And how many times through do we really need to do things to study? How many people know about the seven? Seven times. Unless you're a genius and maybe you do it three. Unless you're Einstein and maybe it's just one, or you have a photographic memory like Jeffrey Bland. Who knows Jeffrey Bland? The guy's got like a photographic memory. He just looks at something and he remembers it, unless he spends hours and hours studying. But you could just say to him, blah, 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 and he'll say, oh, there was a study back in 1947. It was the University of Tufts, and they found that. And I'm like, how do you remember this stuff? How do you remember this stuff? I have to look things up. Anyway, you've got these for triglyceride and cholesterol. You've got them for blood clotting. This is important to know if you're patient has blood clotting issues, right? If they have issues related to blood clotting, you're going to be really careful about their nutrition and about what they're eating. Blood pressure snips, and we see this a lot. And when I've gone back to people who I've been working with who have hypertension, and I look at their genes, I'm like, oh, okay, no wonder. Now we need to change that. Now we need to work harder than the average person to keep that down. Any questions so far? Oh, what to do? What to do. Regardless of what they do, you got to go back to our foundations. Who remembers them? Freedom Foundations. Fun, rest, exercise, environment, diet, outlook, and mindfulness. Okay? It spells freedom so you can remember what those words are. But we want to go down to those foundations. Which of those foundations is out of balance? Remove the obstacles, right? Do an advanced lipid panel. Advanced lipid panel is what will tell you those buoyant versus dense particles. You want to do avoid oxidized fats and excess saturated fats because those are going to damage the walls. They're going to damage the arteries. The other thing I would do in addition to the advanced lipid panel is oxidized LDL. I didn't even really know you could do oxidized LDL. And in a recent re-licensure conference I was at, it was like, oh yeah, I do oxidized LDL on everybody. It's probably a little on the expensive side, but it's definitely good because LDL as LDL is not dangerous, but oxidized LDL is. So you can actually test it. So that's good. You know, regular cardiovascular exercise to their tolerance, stress management, heart math, et cetera. And then the supplementation that they may need. And if they have cardiovascular, they probably need omega-3 fats. Those are very often out of balance in people with cardiovascular. They're going to need more of them because they have these SNPs. A magnesium, CoQ10, niacin, and the herb hawthorn berry. Now, there's other herbs, and we can do a whole thing on herbal medicine. And I'll tell you later about a course that we're going to be doing for on herbal medicine. And I'm so excited about. So inflammation and autoimmune, right? Who said it? Was it Dr. Hopkins or was it somebody, Mike, yesterday, about the so much autoimmune disease around? I think it was Dr. Hopkins seeing that all the time. So much autoimmune disease. It's insane how much autoimmune disease is, right? You'd think it was in the water. Probably is. But so much of it, and we want to look at it, but there's genetics that have people more tendency. So here's the deal. I've been trying to get this one woman to stop eating gluten. Been working with her in our program for a year. She's like, yes, I'm cutting it down. I'm cutting it. But given your symptoms and given your history, you really should be cutting out gluten. We got her genetic testing done. And guess what? She had all the gluten sensitivity SNPs. And I showed it to her and she went, you mean I can't just have a little? No, not unless you want to develop autoimmune disease and keep having your inflammatory disease. You've got to cut it out completely. So these are some of the fat metabolism. That's out of order. That should have been over with the, it might make sense here. It should have been with the cardiovascular. But it's basically the ApoE gene, ApoE, 4-4, they can't manage saturated fats. 4-3, less able. 2s, anytime there's a 2, it's protective. And so 2-2 and 2-3 are more protective. Fortunately, I have a 2-3. Even though both parents dropped dead of heart attacks, my grandmother had a heart attack, my grandfather had a heart attack, I have a 2-3. So it wasn't genetic on their regard, right? It was more and if it was genetic, it was more likely the blood sugar, because I know that we have a lot of that. But the ApoE also predisposes to Alzheimer's. So when people see this, they'll get more motivated. These are the people when they have an ApoE 4-4, or even a 4-3, but mostly 4-4, those are the ones that are on those Esselstyn and Ornish low, 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 low fat diets, and they thrive. Some people don't do well on those diets, actually, but they get those end-stage cardiovascular people who that's what they need, super low fat. And super low fat can cause problems in other areas, and hormones, and cell membranes, and brain functions. We have to find the right balance for each person of how much fat. But what's really, I think, more important than how much is what? Quality and the type of fat that person's eating. So there's the ApoE, and then there's the ApoA, and then there's the PPAR-G. And those are all related to how the body metabolizes fat. So there's our autoimmune and inflammation SNPs. There's a lot of different things, and it talks about the different autoimmune diseases, and there's your celiac SNPs. So if you have a patient who you've been trying to get off gluten because you know that that's going to help them, and they won't go 100%, but they think it's okay to go 99%, you find out if they have any of these SNPs, okay? All right, digestion. You know, when Dr. Allen asked earlier what's the biggest endocrine organ, but I missed the word metabolically active, but the biggest endocrine organ in the body, I was thinking digestion, because there's more hormones in the digestive tract than anything else. In our digestion, nutrigenomics of digestion piece, the hormones of digestion piece in NEPT, in CMDS, we have talk about all those hormones he was talking about, and then some adiponectin and its effect on appetite, effect on inflammation. There's a lot of hormones. I know of about 26 there's probably more that control digestion. So when we think about, nobody even says that the digestive tract is part of the endocrine system, but it's a huge part. So I was thinking digestion, then he pointed out metabolically active, and I'm thinking, okay, fat, right? And we don't think of fat as being an endocrine organ either, do we? Right? We don't think of it, and that's where I come from with the hormones are the master controller of the whole body. So I'm going to talk about one gene that I think is super important that you know about. It's and Steph mentioned it in her talk. Some people call it FUT2. I just say FUT2. You'll see why. Fructosyltransferase. Anyway, it's a gene that tells the body whether it's going to secrete its blood type into mucous membranes. And you're like, so what the heck does that mean and why is that important? Well, as it turns out, when we secrete that into the mucous membranes in the digestive tract, it actually feeds Bifidobacter. Remember Bifidobacter? The king that she was talking about, queen, king, the big player? It feeds it. And if you're not feeding it, then all your life you're going to have to work on that. I got my genes tested, and I'll tell you, before I got my genes tested, I was just like, I crave probiotic foods. Give me sauerkraut, I'll eat the whole jar. Make coconut yogurt, I make a big batch of it, and I'm eating it all. I just can't stop eating it. And so I do my testing, and I have this gene, homozygous, and there were like 7 or 8 of them reported. All of them were homozygous on me. And I'm like, ugh, no wonder I've got to. So I can't go a day without my probiotic food. Right, I just need to keep replenishing it because it's going to die if not, because it's not being fed. So I just keep replenishing it because it's going away every day. So it's basically the non-secretor is what we call me, the non-secretor, and I don't do it. So I'm probably why when I was younger I had so many issues with my sinuses, and they did shots in there and steroids and gave me antibiotics because I kept having these sinus inflammation. It was probably because it's part of it is that FUT2 is supposed to be in there too. I mean, not the FUT2, but you're supposed to secrete in there, and it affects the way that functions. So there's some things that are good about it. It may be easier for me to maintain B12 status. Now, given my genes, I also have some B12-related genes that would make my B12 status, you'd think, lower. But I did an experiment on myself once, and I went a whole year without taking any B12. 100% plant-based, and I've been for 35 years, so I haven't had taken any food forms of it. And I went and I did this MMA, methyl malonic acid, the gold standard for B12 status, and I took it, and I'm like, oh, okay. It was perfect. It was perfect, right? It was perfectly fine. So I probably attribute it, now that I know better, probably this FUT2 thing is protecting me there. And it also protects you about certain kind of viral infections in the gut. And that's never been an issue for me getting, you know, people throw up all the time or have diarrhea from the flu. I've never gotten those. So these, I have 5 of these or 3 of these. And you'll have these in full form on your page. So you can study them, you can look at them. I'm not going to go through them all because, again, it would take me probably 2-3 hours for each of these sections. And those of you who are in NEPT, in the insulin resistance module, there's a whole hour and a half presentation on the ones related to insulin resistance, and in the digestion, there's one related to the genetics of digestion. 2, 3, there you go. Okay, so questions about any of that before I go on to blood sugar? So, in your handout, you have a lot more than I put in here, because I had a lot, and I didn't want to sit here flipping through slides, because I had a lot of them individually mapped on single slides to give you lots of information about each of these. Why? Because I'd done the research because of myself, and I found that of the 50 or so that are known, I have about 36 of them that are either homozygous or heterozygous. So that's why when I eat pineapple, my blood sugar goes up to 185. That's why I have to be super careful about my carb intake, and why the only fruit I eat is blueberries, you know, on a somewhat regular basis. But when I go to Hawaii, if I find that I make a huge green smoothie and I drink that, just greens, no fruit, and I drink that with my mangoes and my papaya and my pink pineapple and my sapote, then I can keep my blood sugar from going too high. And one time, was last year in Mexico, and it was the last night, and we had bought all these mangoes and stuff, and we're like, we can't throw them away. We can't take them on the plane. So we had a feast, and we ate them, and we only had this much spinach left. So I'm like, this much spinach, this much fruit, uh-oh. So I said, what the heck, I'm going to try it. By the time I went to bed, my blood sugar was 185. Okay. It's not my lack of trying, and it wasn't my lack of sleep, because I slept really well when I was there. It wasn't my lack of exercise, because I was running 6 miles on the beach every day. It wasn't my lack of vitamin D, because I was out there all the time. That's where that 5% came in, and I have to be super careful. But I can keep it perfectly normal. I can keep my average blood sugars in the 70s all the time, as long as I know what to eat. And that's what you want to teach people, is to be empowered. And if you're going to make a choice, you know, I made that choice. I was going to enjoy my mangoes for one night. I couldn't go out running because it was like 11 o'clock at night, you know. But it worked. Did you? Can we wait till the end? Or is it? Quick. Oh, how did I feel? Good job. Yeah, how did I feel? She asked, how did I feel when I went up to 185? Starving beyond belief. I wanted to eat everything in sight. I wanted another mango. I wanted a date. I wanted some chocolate. That's how I felt, and that's how I feel when my blood sugar goes up. And I know, whoops, my blood sugar must have gone up because my belly's nice and full, and I want food. I want food, and I discovered that the very first time I tested that, and it makes me starving. And I tried to do, has anybody ever heard of the 80-10-10 diet? Where you're eating like 80% carbohydrate, 10% fat, 10% protein, and it's like I started that, and I got in one day, I made it to the second day, I think the beginning, and I had to quit. It was like, oh, I get to have mangoes and pineapples and all this stuff with my greens, and I did that, and I'm like, when's lunch? When's lunch? I get to eat more mango. I get to eat more. I mean, I was just craving, and then I got unbalanced. It was like this weirdness. So I can't do lots of carb without it making me wacky, and I didn't know that earlier on, right? Once I started testing, I could make the relationship between how I felt and where my blood sugar was. So that was a good question. So this is a chart with some of them. And, oh, the other ones didn't make it in. Okay, so I have an individual page in the notes, in the slides, with a page for each of these plus a whole bunch more. There's like 30 pages of detailed information about the blood sugar SNPs. So those of you who are in NEPT already had them, but now you all have them and you can really look through them and help to evaluate people for blood sugar imbalance because, like Alan said this morning, you know, I'm fine, no prediabetes, I'm fine, I don't have any symptoms. And meanwhile, they do have symptoms like belly fat and brain fog, but they don't associate it with it. But if you can look at their genes and say, it's a matter of time if you don't do something, right? They kept saying to Louisa, it's a matter of time, dear, you're just going to get it, it's your age. And they didn't say, well, if you don't change your diet and your lifestyle, you are going to get diabetes. That would have been, okay, what do I do, right? Right, but they didn't. They said, it's just a matter of time. Just keep eating your Cheerios and your, you know, M&Ms, and, you know, it's going to happen, but you don't have to stop eating those things because they don't make a difference. So, yeah. So there's a lot of them in the notes. And what do you do, right? We have to decrease the sugar load. For me, I've determined what that level is, but by trial and error and testing. You know, we've got to support methylation pathways because they're very important. And we have to look at MTHFR and MTRR and COMT and a bunch of others, and I'll show you a couple of those in a bit. But it's very important. A lot of people, the docs are like, oh, we're hip. We do genetics. Let's do your MTHFR. Like, okay. You're going to do an MTHFR? Like, that's one gene. Do you know how many hundreds of thousands there are that you could be looking at to help people make lifestyle changes? And then what they do is, oh, wow, you have an MTHFR. Take 5 grams of methylfolate and take B12 with it while you're at it, just in case. And then some of those people have other genes that are out of balance, like the COMT, which we'll talk about in a bit. And then they're like pulling their... like from the chandeliers are feeling homicidal, suicidal, and aggressive, and anxious. And the doctors go, oh, well, here, take some Prozac with that. Right? So why? Right? We've got to look at this stuff. It is a small percentage, granted, But when that small percentage is sitting across from you going, I wanted to kill my kid yesterday, and I'm like, I can't take this anymore. You want to know, how much B12 are you taking? And how much methylfolate are you taking? And let's just stop that for a little bit and see what happens. When did you start taking that? About 4 days ago. When did you start feeling this way? About 3.5 days ago. Okay, right? We have to be the detectives, because the Western medicine doesn't have the time in their short appointments, and they don't have the interest, right? Because they're fed information mainly from pharmaceutical companies, right? That's where the medical education is formulated. So we need to, and I'm not dissing it. I love Western medicine. It's awesome when you have trauma. It's awesome when somebody has an acute heart attack and you get them in there and you get the paddles on, right? It's amazing. But let's get them out of their lane, the lane that we belong in, which is chronic illness and chronic low-grade things. That's what we thrive and we can support people on. And I don't care whether you're an MD, a naturopath, an acupuncturist, or a guitar player who decided that, oh my God, there's something here and I need to make changes. And then you do it, right? Steph, you saw what she did. She started out as a guitar teacher 4 years ago, right? But she had so much passion and she has so much intellect and so much intelligence. She learned this stuff so that now she's like digging and figuring it out and asking the perpetual question. That's the most important question in the world. And what's that? Why? Why do you have headaches? Not knock your headache out. Why is your foot hurt? Oh, you just smashed it in a door. Well, let's do some trauma care, right? You don't go to the emergency room and you break your foot and they go, does that hurt? Oh, here, take some Vicodin, see you later. They try to do something for it and set it and all that. So that's where they thrive. You got to recommend foods and herbs that increase insulin sensitivity. That those are the foods, like there's some things carob actually has pinetol in it, which increases sensitivity. Avocados, coconut, green leafy vegetables, basil, all kinds of stuff. So we have a list of that, and if you're in insulin resistance, for sure you have access to it. But there's a book we put together. What's it called? It's the foods that reverse belly fat, brain fog, and burnout. We'll make sure, I think it's already on the page, but if it's not, we'll make sure it's there. And it's a beautiful chart. It's a checklist that I had my graphics designer put together with all these foods, and she got pictures of them. It tells you why, right? Because we have to know why. They may not care why, but we should know why. Why am I recommending blueberries, or why am I recommending basil, or why am I recommending carob? So that's an important thing. We got to teach them how to use that glucose. I'm going to add to what Alan said this morning, which was brilliant. The most important thing that you can do with people is postprandial glucose testing. Now, he talked about doing a glucose tolerant test. He and I have had discussions about, you know, different attitudes about glucose tolerance tests. I just think that going in and having somebody drink down the equivalent of 3 or 4 Pepsi or Sprites or whatever in sugar and then testing is not a realistic test. I tell people eat the highest glycemic load that you normally would eat and let's see what happens. Now, again, he's testing for the tendency in the future, but I'm looking at you identifying for each client or helping them identify for themselves which are the foods that throw them off. Because you can have somebody feeling really sick for a really long time by doing one of those tests, especially if they have a candida overgrowth. Right, you're going to, yeast, fungus, they grow crazy. So I recommend, you know, and I say, what's the highest carbohydrate meal you usually eat? Because a lot of people that go and do those tests, it's because they've been doing the program and they may have stabilized and plateaued and we want to. And they'll say, well, I sometimes eat potatoes and occasionally I eat this or that or I have fruit. So I said, okay, have that high glycemic meal for you and see what happened. I had somebody do that recently, and we did her postprandial insulin and glucose, and her insulin shot up to 22. Now, when she first started, her fasting insulin was 22. So that's an improvement, right? So we get the idea of which foods are and which foods are keeping it nice and steady. So that's important, daily exercise, burst training. There's a new book coming out called Faster Size, and it's this Dr. Wilson who wrote the whole protocol on T3 therapy, and he has been working with this type of exercise that when you do things like shiver or tense your muscles, you know, do these things that make you like sigh and yawn, that it actually, he's been measuring what it does to insulin and glucose levels and ketones and all that. So it's like, if you're hungry and you're trying to fast, go exercise. And not like do a half an hour of aerobics, because that'll make you hungrier, but do these short bursts, because it increases your growth hormone, which increases fat burning. So exercise is a biggie. We didn't have time to have a whole lecture on it, but once I get his book, I'll have more information and we'll do something on it. You know, teach proper timing of meals and supplement if needed. And Mike was saying yesterday, if somebody, how long have you been eating? Every 2 hours, right? People are eating every 2 hours, and there are still some people saying that they should eat every 2 hours. Don't you hear that sometimes? It's like, okay, you want to be an insulin factory, eat every 2 hours. It's great. But if you want to burn fat and you want to get out of the insulin resistance, don't. And then supplements, and there's a whole bunch of supplements. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. And there's some additional resources. These pages have a lot more information if you really want to dig deep. And again, this is in your notes. I couldn't leave without brain chemistry, because Alzheimer's is related to metabolic disorders. Excess glucose, excess insulin affects the brain. Any questions about the glucose before we move on to that? Okay, we'll do that, and hopefully we'll have time for a few. Okay, so brain chemistry, right? This one I have to mention, COMT, catecholamine O-methyl transferase. It's a pathway that breaks down estrogens in the body. It also breaks down dopamine, all the catecholamines. So it's like when we're trying to metabolize and get the used up products of these out of the body, it gets involved. So when someone has a breakdown of this enzyme, we can't get rid of the dopamine after we use it, or the serotonin after we use it, or the catecholamines. And we end up possibly with a lot of anxiety. Okay? So we have this impotent neurotransmitters trying to work in the body, and they can't. So the estrogen metabolism, the brain function, you just have to be really careful with this if you're working with somebody with an MTHFR and you want to give them methyl donors. It can be really dangerous and bad. MAO, this is a funny one. So my husband's mother, my mother-in-law, is very OCD. Like, I mean, to the point where she keeps a coffee pot in the kitchen that was broken because it had a pink flower on it that matched her wallpaper. Okay? She would keep all the newspapers until she read them, and she had a whole room stacked high with newspapers, and she would literally sit at the table reading six-month-old Target inserts from the newspaper. And it got worse as she got older. And I said to him one day, he did something like really OCD-like, and I said, oh my God, you inherited your mother's OCD gene. And it was when I was first getting started in the gene things. So we ran our tests, and I get this back, and he has an MAO, which is sex-linked, which means you only got it from mom. And the combination of MAO with a VDR and a COMT gives you more of a tendency to, guess what? OCD. I went, oh my God, you really did inherit your mother's OCD gene. Anyway. It's a running joke in our family. So MAO, you know, with the COMT, it says it at the bottom, or smooth swings and OCD. I want to talk about GAD because they see these a lot, and I have a ton of them. So people, GAD could stand for generalized anxiety disorder, but what it really stands for is glutamic acid decarboxylase, and it's an enzyme that converts from glutamic acid into GABA. Glutamic acid is an excitatory neurotransmitter. GABA is a calming neurotransmitter. So people with some problems here will tend to be those, you know, high strung and everything, you know, and it's in my family. Everybody in my family's on anti-anxiety medications because they're all, like, they get so worried about everything. And so I've learned to manage it with meditation and heart math, because I'd be like that too, right? Because of my genes, I got a whole slew of them, and it's a problem, right? It could be a problem. So when you're working with those folks, the best thing you can do is to help support them in their stress. Okay, help them support them in their stress, and, you know, help them support with nutrients that help support GABA and help bring down, get them off of MSG and anything that converts to glutamate, right? Any of those preservatives. And then other brain-related SNPs, these are ones, dopamine beta hydroxylase, it has to do with dopamine breakdown, conversion to norepinephrine, DAO, these are all important. And ApoE, even the ApoE has to do with brain chemistry because of Alzheimer's, right? So when people have these, you have to work with them a little differently, let's just say, right? When they have a lot of these anxiety genes, you talk softly to them. I have to calm my normal craziness down when I'm talking to these people. And I've learned to predict who's going to be that. They walk in and I'm talking to them. I'm like, oh, they got DAD. They got, you know, I'm writing it down and then I do it and I'm like, oh, yep. So you learn to like understand that pattern, right? But you have to know techniques, understand how do you get the GABA. GABA doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier unless the blood-brain barrier is compromised. So if somebody says they're taking GABA and having great results, it's scary. Like, because they may have a compromised blood-brain barrier, because what else is getting into their brain that shouldn't? That's not supposed to cross the blood-brain barrier, right? So I had one person who had all this stuff going on, and you can have them take high doses of GABA, and I had her take 1,000 milligrams. I said, just tell me how you feel when you take it. And she goes, oh, I felt heavenly. I felt so calm. I'm like, oh, shit. I'm sorry. Like, your blood-brain barrier is compromised. I'm sorry to say we have to work on it. I mean, your blood-brain barrier. And people with blood-brain barrier have leaky gut. Leaky gut, leaky brain. And if somebody has leaky gut, assume they have leaky brain and really work really carefully to avoid the chemicals, their chemical exposures, right? They shouldn't be spraying, you know, stuff on their lawn and, you know, their air fresheners in the air. Okay, we're done. And there's your brain SNPs. There's your Alzheimer's SNPs. There's your mental SNPs. And then Parkinson's related SNPs. An action plan is the foundations. We always have to come back to the foundations, regardless, right? We need good, healthy diet, lifestyle, optimized stomach acid, so you get the right amount of protein, because proteins are broken down into amino acids, and amino acids make what? Neurotransmitters, right? We need amino acids to make neurotransmitters. What else do we need to make neurotransmitters? What nutrient? Starts with a B. B vitamins! B6 especially B6, right? So we have to watch that, and we have seen people, and they're like, oh, the doctor wants to put me on Prozac. Well, let's look at making sure we optimize your stomach digestion, get your protein absorbed. Are you eating enough protein? Are you digesting enough? And what are your B vitamins like? And some people have, and we don't have time to go into it, but we did last year's class. The heck is that? All right, I guess I'm done. Last year, we went into all the nutrient SNPs, and that book will have that in there. So you can look up, and if they have a B6 SNP, right, they're going to need more, especially if they're anxious and they're depressed and they have some ADD or whatever, then we want to make sure that they're getting enough of that, right? And I'm all for food, but, you know, combination of years and decades of bad lifestyle and not enough of that, drugs that interfere with the absorption, and one of the ones is birth control pills, right? That interferes with B6 big time. So people are on these medications for a long time. They're going to need supplementation. I try to give as little supplementation as possible. I am not one that you go in the office and we run $1,000 worth of tests and then give you $500 a month worth of supplements to take, because I don't think that's getting to the why. Maybe the first month, maybe when you're doing a special detox protocol, but why? What are the detox pathways doing? You know, what's everything else? What's the digestion doing, the blood sugar, et cetera? Is this starting to make sense, right? And it's not so complicated, because these are things you can have as chart. You can print off my charts. You can get the book, and you'll have a great time. So.